But if you ran it multiple times, you'd still got, it still get some kind of cat dustbin hybrid, but it would look different.
You'd recognize the dustbin-ness in it, and it makes you think dustbin. But
it's a stupid conversation. Welcome, one and all, to Bad Voltage Season 3, Episode 44, this season that will never, ever, ever, ever end. I suspect this will never... What's going to happen for it to change to Season 4? We're going to like start it in the metaverse or something?
What I honestly can't remember is... Where did we get to with Season 2? Because I'm now slightly worried that what happened is we got near 100 and then I got scared that a three-digit episode number would break everything, and that's why we changed seasons.
Yeah, I think that was it. Well, Season 1 was when we were with Brian, so there was a logical change to Season 2, and then I can't remember when we went to Season 3.
I honestly think that, but you know how everyone was worried about after Windows 95 when it came out, its version number was actually 4 or something, because it would break every batch script on Earth that assumed that the version number had gone up by 91 or whatever. Anyway.
Good times. Anyway, sadly, we don't have our little friend and compadre, Jeremy Garcia, with us today. I know we've had a little bit. It took us forever to do a show, and then I wasn't on one, and now he's not on one. Now, I know some of you get a little bit nervous about this. Don't worry, Mum and Dad aren't breaking up, okay? We're all still friends. However, we are having a threesome today with a friend of the family, and that's Alan Pope. So it's good to have you back, Mr. Pope. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking me. It's very kind.
Yeah, it's sexy. Before we get to you and your shenanigans, what are we going to talk about in the show? Language.
So my main topic of conversation, the thing I want to talk about, is AI generated artwork. So there's been a recent spate over the last couple of years of things being generated by AI, imagery and videos and so on. And a few things have come up recently which brought it back to the forefront of my mind. Something that Aza Raskin, friend of the show, did, or possibly friend of the previous show, depending on how you look at it. And, but I want to talk about something he did recently as an art piece and how that plays into some bigger thoughts about copyright and ownership and the nature of art and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, we're gonna get Berkeley in this one. is it a spate or is it a spat?
It's a spate. A spat is an argument.
Well, that's what I thought too. But I've heard people say there's been a recent spat of, I don't know, shootings going on or whatever.
Those people are wrong. Secondly, you've Colonel Kurtz, you have gone fully native. If literally the first thing you thought of was shootings, you should move home.
I appreciate that.
And thirdly, yeah, I've also heard people around you say things like herbs, and they're also wrong. And niche.
That annoys the shit out of me.
Niche, for that matter, is
niche,
worse.
Niche annoys the shit out of me. And herbs. It's like, come on. All right, so before we get into channeling our inner Jerry Garcia, Popey, what have you been up to? It's been a while. What have you been working on?
Well, it's coming close to 1 year since I left Canonical. And
has it been that long? Really?
Yeah, it has. Wow. Yeah, 30th of April. and I was bored last weekend, so I thought I'd write some code, like you do. I mean... I call it code. It's a shell script. And I thought I'd make something fun and interesting that people might like. And so I created a thing which users can run on their system, and it audits all the snaps that are installed on their Linux desktop machine, probably, and then figures out the correlating flatpak for that snap, and then installs the flatpak, and then uninstalls the snap. And optionally, completely removes snapd as well. You can completely nuke it from orbit. So, yeah, I made that. And a couple of people made news articles about it.
It's the orange purge.
A bit, yeah.
Wow. It was a big picture of an Ubuntu logo and like a middle finger.
Actually, it's the Snapcraft logo with a red circle and a red line through it, and it's called Unsnap.
Wow. So when you left Canonical, did someone take a shit in your, like, parting gift bag or something? Like,
there's a nice animated gif of Homer Simpson driving across a bridge and throwing a match out behind him as he goes. I think it's a bit that has been referenced.
This is interesting because, I mean, obviously on the last show we had George Castro on, and he was talking about flat packs. And this is another thing. Is this, you know, the tables turning, or is this just some men want to watch the world burn kind of approach?
A bit. I don't know. I think it's just a useful utility. I when I worked on the Snap team, and we kept an eye on what was in the flat pack, flat hub store, and we obviously worked hard to get loads of stuff in the Snap store. And since I've left, I don't think the momentum has been kept up on the Snap side, but it has on the flat pack side. And there is a lot more momentum in applications. And so I just thought, well, if that's where the momentum is, if there's more people putting more packages in flat hub, then why not help people migrate from one to the other? It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Which I think, I mean, as you say in the README, it's a utility. It's for people who want this and will find it useful. It's not a political statement. I mean, it's been perceived as such by quite a few people. But to be honest with you, while you were on the Snaps team, everything you did was perceived as a political statement one way or the other. And none of it was then either. So.
Yeah. It's like, exactly. I mean, either way, people are going to take that viewpoint, aren't they? You know? You're not doing this to be snide, right? You do this because you think it's helpful for people.
And it's funny how the messages I've had from people, DMs from people about this, you know, telling me that their perspective of me has changed, as if as if I'm suddenly a virtuous person because I make this shell script and put it on GitHub, or that actually I was a complete shithead when I worked for Canonical and now I'm slightly less of a shithead because I help people move from snaps to flat packs. I don't know. It's very weird that people like seem to think that because someone pays you to do something and that's the thing you do, that's all you can ever do, and you can never change your perspective, you can never have any other point of view, and it's all set in stone, which is just ludicrous nonsense.
I mean, that exists everywhere in the world, right? But I feel like it exists especially in certain portions of the open source community, right? And especially in the Linux world. Like, it's become quite tribal. It certainly was years ago. But like, yeah, it's so silly because you can be more than one person, right? Like, it's okay.
And someone left a comment on Reddit that said something like, "Oh, what if someone creates a utility that goes the other way, that converts people from flatbacks to snaps?" And I'm like, yeah, go for it. Knock yourself out. I'm probably not going to create that, but someone could use the metadata that I've got. I've got this, all it is a CSV file with a list of snaps and a one-to-one mapping to a list of flatbacks. You could just use that same file and convert the other way. Go for it. I don't care. It's fine. It doesn't matter.
Wow.
I think it would be really useful to make that like a collaborative project, right? Have more people. I mean, I know you've so one of the things Unsnap does, which is rather nice, is it creates a list of snaps you've got which don't seem to have a corresponding flat pack at the moment, which you can then easily drop into a GitHub issue, which means that Alan can then pick it up or someone else can pick it up and go, okay, now this is a target of things to package for Flatpak or to update the file because there is a corresponding thing or whatever. And there's no reason why that couldn't be used in reverse too. Great, no problem at all. But
yeah,
it's – I don't know what you'd call it, this – all the stop energy you get from people who – they want to be tribal. They want to find partisan reasons to have a go at anything the other people do just because all they know how to do is argue. I mean, this sort of thing shows up in politics a lot as well.
Yeah,
but the idea that the opposition give out free ice cream and you've got to find some reason to complain about it.
Right. It's really irritating. The thing that really bugs me is whenever, like you say, other people, the other side does good things, right? And people will refuse to acknowledge it. Like a Linux distro puts out a really cool piece of technology, or, you know, you see this, for example, when you see this in the State of the Union, when, you know, something good happened and half the room won't applaud it.
Yeah.
Just out of, just because they're not on the same side. It's like, come on, people. Like, we're all human beings. So anyway, but that's interesting, Popey. Have you had any snarky words from Canonical about this?
No. My little bird tells me there have been conversations internally about it. unsurprisingly. But it's on GitHub, and if people want to find it, it's on my GitHub repository, popey/unsnap. And if people want to help check it on different distros or make sure it's compatible with different distros and also contribute to the app list, as Stuart said, it's just a CSV file with a list of snaps and a list of flatpaks. And if people want to add to that, some people already have, but it could always be made better. And I've actually just reported an issue earlier today where I've provided a list of every snap in the store and a list of every flatpak in FlatHub. And I don't know if someone could programmatically fuzz the list together to find those matches, or if humans want to just do it for me, that would be great as well.
Oh, I see.
This feels like a human thing to me. So,
yes.
So full disclosure on this, I was aware of this project because the logo was designed by me for a start. Not that it was hard, but, you know, and I did some early testing and so on. And one of the things I like about it is that it's quite sensitively handled. So it's a terminal utility, a command line utility, right? But equally, the only people who do this have skin in the game. They have some kind of a reason to make this shift, which is semi-political in nature, even if the tool itself is not. Anyone using it is. And the number of people who would be like, I don't know how to use a terminal, but do want the thing that this does is zero.
Yeah.
So I don't mind that it's a terminal tool, because anyone who's like, but I don't understand the terminal for this kind of thing, you'd be like, well, you shouldn't be caring about what format your thing arrives in. Just install from the software center and you're good.
Just go to the software center.
Why would
and
you
there.
Even care right. about what format yeah. the archive that your programs arrive in is, right? No well, one cares.
You might care if they're slower to start or they have confinement, which makes them harder to use. That you might care then.
Maybe, but then what you're doing is you're digging yourself the immediate grave of having to build GUI unsnap, which you probably don't want to do because it's a lot harder.
No. Someone did suggest that I should publish unsnap in the snap store as like a snake eating itself. So someone snap installs unsnap and it then
that's like next level trolling at that
yes,
point.
It is.
I feel like that would be probably a bridge too far. But as I said, the thing I liked about it being semi-sensitive is you don't run it and then it does it. What happens is you run it and then it generates a set of shell scripts which do it. So you can then look at those and then run them one at a time. And the first one will make sure you've got Flatpak installed. And the second one will make sure you've got FlatHub installed. And the third one will actually install all the Flatpaks you need. And the fourth one will then uninstall the snaps. And the fifth one will remove snap itself. So it's got this quite sensible, softly, softly catchy monkey. You may remember, you'll both remember the thing, but I can't remember the name of it. In the old days, with Ubuntu, there used to be a third-party bash script, which would add a bunch of other repositories and remove a bunch of stuff, and it did apt-get --force, and then installed a bunch of things, and I can't think of the name of it, and it was the worst because their pitch was all just run this and it installs Flash for you.
I've got it.
The NVIDIA Automatics. It was
that's
called,
it.
Right?
Yeah, that's right,
and. The goal that it had wasn't necessarily a bad one. It was basically get Ubuntu and turn it into what became Linux Mint, right? Where it downloads and installs loads of packages and doesn't care about security. But the unsnap doesn't work that way. The problem with automatics was not what it did, it was how it did it. So it's like, I'll just install over the top of all the stuff you've got and I'll just turn off all the warnings because you don't understand the warnings. You're like, they're there for a reason. And I like the fact that this doesn't do that.
Yeah.
So good work, Mr. Pope.
Good work, Pope.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Interesting stuff.
So do people go to github.com/popey/unsnap to get it?
Yep, absolutely. You just clone the repo. There's instructions in there. Just clone the repo and run unsnap. But there is a warning in there that says the status is, I think I called it pre-alpha, which means it kind of works on my computer.
It works in your computer alone.
Yes. But other people have tested it. It seems to work.
This is like the software release version of grade inflation that People now just run software which is beta. Like, I think Gmail might still be in beta. So now we need a word for pre-alpha, which you're not supposed to need. That's what alpha is meant to mean. So, can I talk about AI?
Yes, let's talk about this. I'm quite excited about this discussion. Yeah. It's going to be very interesting.
So, a bit of backstory. Friend of the show, Aza Raskin, who spoke at Lug Radio Live, is a cool guy, wears a hat.
Definitely wears hats.
That was like...
Does he still wear hats?
Not as much, I have to say.
This is a very old joke.
It is a very old joke. We used to take the piss out of him wearing weird hats. Like 16 years ago or so.
We had a competition where people would Photoshop their own like stupid hats onto pictures of Aza Raskin. And he was cool about it.
He was. And the competition was called Stupid Hat for Corporate Tat.
That's right. We did provide some corporate tat.
Wow.
Back in the days when naming was the most important thing in a podcast.
Anyway, right. Aza's done a bunch of stuff, and he's part of the Center for Humane Technologies, and he does a lot of kind of thinking about the way technology is and how it fits into the world.
Yeah, he's a cool guy.
He is a cool guy. He's really smart. And he's been working with a woman called Zia Cora. Zia Cora. And she's a musician, and she wrote a song called Submarines. And he made the video for it. But the way he did it was to use an AI tool called Disco Diffusion, where what you can do is you can feed it a query, a textual query, and it will then generate an image for that query. And it's alarmingly good at it, right?
It's incredible, yeah.
The images you get tend to have quite a sort of a dreamlike quality, but they are recognizably the thing that you entered. And it's not just like, you know, a flower. You can feed it names of actual people and their faces will show up, and you can feed it quite accurate descriptions of a scene, and you get, you know, outside in a market at night in a medieval town, with stars in the sky and Brian Blessed in the foreground, and it will do a reasonable job at it. It's mad. These things are really, really impressive. Yeah. But the thing that I've seen that before. Everyone's seen that before. I'm sure you've all seen things like This Face Does Not Exist, which is generated by a StyleGAN AI network.
Yep.
Very recently, Simon Butcher and Terence Eden collectively put together, well, Simon did, I think, a lot of the AI work, collectively put together a thing called This Bench Does Not Exist, which is trained on the Open Benches data set of images. So now it generates realistic looking benches that aren't actually real, right? This stuff works on anything.
Did you say Open Benches?
Yeah.
It's Open Benches is awesome. If you're if you're out and about and you see a memorial bench, so a bench that's got a little plaque on it, you take a photo of the plaque, you take a photo of the bench, you take a photo from the bench. You could take multiple, like, and do a panorama and everything, but you take two or three photos, you get it Open Benches, and you just add that bench if it's not already in the database. And it will do OCR to determine the inscription, and you can correct that if there's any, you know, if it's a blurry or not very clear, indistinct, you can correct the inscription and upload all the photos. And because they're GPS tagged by your phone, then the location of the bench is recorded in Open Benches, and then someone else can then find that bench either by searching for the name of the person whose inscription it memorializes, or just by zooming in on a map and finding somewhere near where they are. I've submitted a whole bunch to it. When I'm on holiday and I see a bench and it's got an inscription on it, the kids will be like, "Dad, there's another one," and I'll submit
That's
it.
That's cool.
Good.
It's OpenStreetMap, but for benches.
Yes.
It's amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I just found some benches near me.
See, this
that's
is
interesting.
I'm amazed that's not in, you know, the Google thing. You type restaurants near me in Google Maps, you'd be like, benches near me.
Benches near me.
Anyway, so the thing that Aza did when he put together the video for this song by Zia Cora is he used Disco Diffusion to string together a bunch of images. And this is the thing which prompted me to think, wow, I've not seen this before. I'd seen a bunch of AI-generated artwork, but it was all still imagery. What he did was he basically wrote a list of textual queries are things like dead face charcoal sketch, or Salvador Dali on a clock face, or a pile of candy as depicted on Art Station. Stuff like this, right? A list of 30 or so queries. And then he fed that to Disco Diffusion as one thing. It takes a while to generate this stuff, but so it'll generate not only a frame for each of those, but frames to animate one into the next one. So you feed it 30 queries and tell it, you know, each one should be, I don't know, 3 or 4 seconds long and fade into the next. And you get out a 3 or 4 minute video, a music video, which means that he went from not having a music video at all to having generated this thing in 48 hours. He opened no image editing tools, nothing. All he did was write the list of queries, feed it to Disco Diffusion, gets out a music video. Job done.
All he did is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
All right, yeah, don't get me wrong. We'll dig into the detail a bit here. But that to me that's fascinating because, I mean, I could do that, right? I can't paint to save my life. The musical ability, artistic ability of a rubber hammer is just, you know, the way it is. But I can enter in text queries and get out. It gives me a way of, to some extent, being able to visualize what's in my head, outside my head, right?
Mm.
How many times have you thought about something you'd like to see, some piece of art you'd like to create, a slide layout you'd like to do, a room visualization you want, and what you'd like to do is just press a button on the side of your head and have it print out so you could look at it and show it to other people, right? I mean, hands up here who has done writing for money, right? The goal of writing for money is to find some way of depicting with words a thing that's inside your head to people outside your head. And it's really bloody difficult.
It is, yeah.
So I've seen the video, and I've also seen the Open Bench stuff, and Simon also did some wallpapers for Ubuntu based on the animal names, the release names in the past, and also made a video of one transitioning to the next. Same kind of thing, AI generated.
That is done with Disco Diffusion. Same thing, yes.
Right. And they're all very interesting and very cool, but I do worry that the novelty of it will wear off very fast. Like, I didn't even watch the whole of that video because I kind of knew what was happening. So, you know, having seen all of the videos that Simon's made and all of the wallpapers that he's made and seen the Open Benches stuff, I felt like once I'd got like a minute or two into that music video, I've experienced what it's doing. And I don't know that if you show me another one that was a different music video or some other creation, not necessarily a music video, maybe it was a drive round an imaginary village or something, and it generated the entire village, you know, I think after a couple of minutes, I would get bored of that as well, because I feel they're all very samey.
Well, so to be clear here, it is early days for this sort of technology. So what Aza is doing there, and what a lot of people are doing with this at the moment, is essentially stringing together just a collection of images. And so, yeah, it does tend to generate the same kind of art. Disco Diffusion generates images which feel similar to one another.
It's a style, isn't it?
Yeah, and if what you're doing is moving from one of those to the next and that's your thing, then yeah. But essentially having a bunch of set pieces and moving between them is the art of storytelling. And so someone who makes a film, that's their job to do. And at the moment, people aren't really trying to do that. The very fact that you can type in dead face charcoal sketch and get an image of it 10 minutes later is amazing enough by itself. That what I think Aza has done is he's not really telling a story. One of the things that a bunch of people said when it was published, Zia and Aza video, was to say it would be good if the imagery and the song reflected one another. And he's like, yeah, that's the next project, right?
Oh, so is the music video, is the video not using lyrics from the song?
Not really, no. It's meant to be, yeah. What he didn't do was just feed it essentially the lyrics. What you get is pictures of what Ziacor is singing about. No, it's like most music videos, right? It's all very abstract. But I think that I'm not worried about. The thing where you say it's all quite samey, that I'm not worried about, because what it needs is someone with some storytelling skill You know, you want, I don't want to have a pop at Asa here and suggest that he hasn't, that he just wasn't trying for this first one. But the idea of going, okay, I've got a series of small set pieces, now I'm going to turn them into a unifying story with meaning and so on, is Francis Ford Coppola's job. It's not the people who design the AI's job.
And Asa would certainly agree that there were going to be people out there who are much better than him at doing that, right?
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is, recently, this is tangentially related, you know, recently I'm working on some music for the next Baron Carter release, and I was putting together, and I found this woman on Fiverr who makes music videos, and obviously to film an actual music video is very expensive and all the rest of it. It wouldn't work for us because the band members are in different countries. But what she does is she makes music videos out of stock footage. So she, you know, she's a member of Storyblocks or whatever. And what I did is I basically sent her the lyrics and explained what was going on at that point of the song. And then in a similar way, she was pulling bits of stock footage and assembling it together to tell the story of the song. And
okay,
it seems to me it's similar in spirit here, right? Is that what you're doing is you're writing source code for a music video that might not necessarily be the lyrics, but it might mirror kind of what's going on. The difference here is that instead of grabbing stock footage, it's actually creating visually what it's going to look like.
It feels like what you're explaining is like using Node and NPM, and you're pulling in a bunch of pre-written modules and putting them together to make a project, right? Yeah. Whereas this thing is more like the GitHub code generator thing.
GitHub Copilot.
Exactly. It's
the analogy to those two, I think.
It is. I mean, part of the thing that I find interesting, you, Jono, there, you said source code, and Alan, you talk about, you know, GitHub Copilot and pulling in code and things like that. I don't know what my intuition is on this, because I've done some work with this for an upcoming project and so on. And I've done a bunch of this and a lot of talking to Simon and Martin Wimpress, friend of the show, and people who are working on this. And one of the things that becomes quite apparent is there's quite a lot of skill in choosing the right queries. It's not just a question of you type anything you like and then you get the thing you want. Learning to phrase it in a way that it gets is really interesting, especially since this is a skill, because it's not like normal computer programs where you go, well, that's, you're doing it wrong. If you say this, it'll be better because you understand the underlying Python code. Because it's bloody AI, you have to learn to use it like it's an instrument or something. There's no actual right answer, which is, on the one hand, amazing. And on the other hand, it's bloody infuriating. The idea that you can write a computer program and not understand how it works. It's a black box.
You can't say to GitHub Copilot, please make me VR Minecraft, and expect it to just like magic.
Just spit it out.
The code
not this year. Maybe GitLab Copilot could do that. but more importantly, I'm interested in your intuitions on what this is. Like, are those queries the source code for Asa's video? If you were to do a similar thing, you had to put in some effort to come up with the queries which correctly expressed your view, and you probably would go, that's not really the image I want. I'll go in and refine that query, and I'll go in and refine that query. So beyond the mechanical aspects of it, where you say, I want each one to be 5 seconds long or whatever, there is actual creativity in this. This is not like writing the phone book. So if those are the source code, if someone else takes that source code and then runs it through Disco Diffusion themselves and gets a similar but not identical video, is that, in your opinion, a derivative work of your video? I don't care about what lawyers will say, because there's a whole raft of legal stuff coming about this in the future. Be prepared, lawyers. Buckle up. But I'm interested in your intuition. So Asa published all the queries that he used to generate this video. He said, built this video in 48 hours. These are the queries I used to do it. If you took that, ran it yourself, and got, as I say, a different, if you run the same query through DD twice, you get two different images. They're both images for the query, but they're not the same. It's not.
Quick clarifying question. So when you're using Disco Biscuits or whatever it's called.
Disco Diffusion. But there are loads of others, to be clear.
The way the AI is trained is it's fed images, right? It's fed all kinds of different images. So if I was to take...
It's fed both images and images with text prompts.
Okay. So I was just going to say, like, is Disco Diffusion something you run on your machine locally, or is that like a service? Like, if I was, would I run, if I was to copy Aza's source code and run it through Disco Diffusion, running it through the same Disco Diffusion that he used is one thing. But then if I was to take my Disco Diffusion and teach it a whole bunch of different images.
If you run it with the same thing he did, you will still get different images. If you run it with your query and then run it with your query again 30 seconds later, you'll get two different images.
But my question is to me, there's a difference between running the same source code through the same Disco Diffusion or running the same source code through a Disco Diffusion that's been trained on different images. Because stylistically, it's going to look different, isn't it?
Yes, but DD is the whole point of Disco Diffusion is the training model, which is this, everyone uses the same one.
Right.
For this particular thing. There are lots of other different things, but they're all on the same model. Most people don't run it on their own machines because if you run it in the cloud, you can run it on a farm where they've got loads of NVIDIA cards and you haven't. So it's faster.
Right.
Because you can run it on your own machine. And Simon, for example, does because he has a million NVIDIA cards, which I don't.
Because the only reason why I'm asking this is that in my mind, let's say you take Aza's source code and you were to run it through Disco Diffusion with the same model, right?
Yep.
Stylist, like to me, that's more. This is not the right set of words, but that's more ripping something off than if you were to run it through a different model where stylist. To use a simple example, imagine Disco, whatever it's called, has been trained on Backstreet Boys style imagery. It's all, you know, dudes sat there with white clothes on benches and stuff like that. That kind of look. But then the alternative is you have a black metal, like Satan evil kind of model where everything's dark and miserable and gloomy. You're going to get very, very different output, I would imagine. And to me, that's part of the process. That's to me is part of the decision.
I understand what you're saying. The model is the hard thing. So right. Everyone tends to use the same model because training a model takes a lot of time and effort right. And NVIDIA cards.
Which is fair enough. Yeah, yeah.
So in general, everyone shares the model. Disco Diffusion is the combination of that algorithm and another algorithm and that model. And there are a bunch of different models you can download for it, like six or something. But in general, people don't train their own model.
How different is it if you were to run the same, if you were to run Aza's source code to Disco Diffusion again, how different do the images look? Do you know? Are they like slightly different colors, but the same thing?
No.
Are they totally different?
They are recognizably images of the same query, but they can be very different. This is really hard to describe with words, right? Because the images themselves are quite hard to describe with words because they're always quite conceptual and dreamy. You can recognize them for what they are, but it's not like here is one thing and here is another.
It's like they often look like they're transitional images between a from and a to, like it's going from a laptop to a pot noodle, right? And halfway in between, you kind of partly see a pot noodle and you kind of partly see a laptop. And it's the same going from a cat to a dustbin. It's like, well, it's a cat with like dustbin features, or it's a dustbin with cat features. And they're all a bit like that. But if you ran it multiple times, you'd still get some kind of cat dustbin hybrid, but it would look different.
You recognize the dustbin-ness in it, and it makes you think dustbin. But it's
a stupid conversation.
I say it's hard to describe, man.
So, going back to your question, Stuart.
Yeah. What's your intuition on this?
Well, I have difficulty with this saying that the query is the source code. Because, like, if I try and map this to our open source world, we have compilers and documentation and libraries and APIs and source code in the open source world. And it's not just one part of that that makes the product. It's not just the source code that makes the product. There's all the libraries and the documentation and the inherent knowledge that you've built that's standing on the shoulders of giants behind you and the compilers that were built with other compilers that were built with other compilers and so on and so on. There's a lot that was built up to build where you are now.
Yeah, there's a lineage, right?
Yeah. And I feel like the AI model is like an accelerated version of some of that. And it's playing a very big part in this. And the human who's coming up with the queries And then, as you've said, generates different images. So there's probably some curation in there as well. I would imagine they selectively choose some that are good and some that are bad. Because I've seen what Simon's generated, and some of them he's thrown away. He's got many, many images, and he curates them. So there is some human element in this beyond just the source code of the query that was entered to get the images in the first place, because you get 1,000 images, and some of them looks like cat dustbin hybrids and hybrids, and some of them just look like trash, right? And so it's more than just source code. And so I don't think you can limit your blanket, you know, intuition about whether this is copyright theft or, you know, stealing somebody else's work, when there's so much else in there other than just the source code.
I think, part of the reason that I don't think I have an intuition on this is that I don't think it does map very well onto the existing world. Because take your thing, right? So if you write a program at work, it did a thing, whatever, that would obviously be owned by your company, right? Not you. But then if you go home and write Unsnap at home, all the stuff you described, the compiler and the interpreter you're using and your background knowledge and the text editor you used and the environment you built it in and the headspace and all your learning you've done would be the same. The only thing that actually changes is the source code, but that's the copyrightable bit.
It's not,
but
entirely
that doesn't
the
seem
same.
To map on to this
because
in
I've,
my
I,
head.
No, because I've learned from the thing I did at work that day. So if you draw a cat now and then tomorrow someone says, draw another cat, and I mean you, human being, Stuart Langridge, draw on a piece of paper a cat, they'll both resemble cats, but they won't be identical. Just the same.
If I do
as
it, it'll look like a cat dustbin hybrid. But yeah,
of course. nice callback. But if I wrote something at work, and then I go home, and the very same day, without looking at the code that I did at work, like imagine that's locked away proprietary code at work, and I go home and I'll start trying to write the same thing again, I can't hold the mental model of all that code in my head. And I would start writing, and I would write something different than I wrote earlier, because I would have learned from what I wrote earlier. And I might think, well, actually, at work, I did this thing, and actually, there's probably a better way of doing that. Or the garbage collection could be done differently. Or maybe the documentation could be better. Or I could break the program down into different modules. And so we're not automatons. And so we wouldn't write the same thing twice. I don't think. Once you get beyond like 1,000 lines of code, you're not going to write the same code every time.
Well, and the thing is, as well, is the I guess what's probably a better description than source code for Aza's thing is it's more like a script, right? And
yes, like a screenplay script, you mean.
It's like a screenplay. And in reality, the screenplay is 5% of the situation, right? Like it's the manifestation, the visualization.
Have you ever run into any screenwriters who would punch you in the face for claiming that it's 5%? I get it's not 100%, but 5 is harsh.
But I'm not talking about screenwriters. I'm talking about the person who consumes the content, right? They care about the performance and
lighting,
the way it looks,
music.
And,
yep.
Yeah, all of those different pieces. Like that's my concern with this. With this thing is that you might be able to share the source code or the screenplay or whatever, however we describe it. But going back to my example of the video that I'm putting together for my band right now, when this woman was putting all these bits of stock footage together, a big chunk of the skill was her lining up thematically similar stuff that looked and she'd do like color grading and all the rest of it to make it look cool. Because if I'd have done it, I'd have just ended up with all kinds of random things. It would look like a hodgepodge.
Yeah.
And I think that to me, that's why I was asking earlier on about what the imagery looks like, because that to me is going to be the most important piece. Who cares if you use the same screenplay? What matters is the output of the video.
So there's been a new model released called DALL-E. That's only in the last week or so, and I'm on the waiting list to get in and play with it, and I haven't yet. But that apparently generates even better images from prompts and so on. And I think that will continue being refined, but that's being refined by other people. What to me is more interesting is not the model necessarily. We should acknowledge here that there's a whole big question about these models tend to be trained on public imagery, which is not necessarily public domain imagery. And there's a whole big legal copyright question about that, but we got into that about GitHub Copilot, so I don't really want to get into it again. But leaving that to one side, to me, it's not the model's not interesting. It's what people are doing with it. In the same way that the people who make instruments are not interesting, it's the people who play them. I care much more about AC/DC than I care about Les Paul.
But what's interesting to me is
don't think what did Angus play? Don't think it was a Les Paul.
No, he played a Gibson SG.
I thought you'd know. Okay.
Yeah. Continues to play a Gibson SG. It's the other one that died, sadly. What's interesting is we're saying that it's like the model in my mind is the meaningful bit, but you're saying that in your mind, Ack, the meaningful bit is the script or the screenplay, right? Because to me, what generates the artistic output is the model. Like, and that's the differentiation.
Well, it's a sum of all the inputs. It's not just the model. The model is one of the inputs, and the script is another one of the inputs. And then the curation of the person who's put those in is another person, is another part of
the
inputs.
It's all of it. Frankly, yeah, it's everything, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is why I was trying to map this to, like, compilers, documentation, libraries, APIs. It's not just the source code. Like, it's the culmination of lots of things put together, the work of many people. Like, all those photos that were taken that were fed into this model. Like, I took a load of photos that are in Open Benches that Simon downloaded and fed into the model. And so some of my artistic work, the way I took photos of benches, has fed into that model. So I have input in that that has come up with this bench does not exist, those pictures that exist now.
Yeah.
But was I a pivotal part of that? No. I mean, you could argue that it wouldn't exist if hundreds of us didn't take photos of benches.
And that does seem to map onto the open source world quite a lot. Like, I have code in the desktop that certainly me and Alan are both looking at. Not a lot of code. Am I a pivotal part of it? No. But I'm able to look at this and go, I contributed to this.
You helped.
I was going to say it's a little bit better, but it's a little bit different because of what I did.
I don't think it's unfair to say it's pivotal, because if you surgically extract all of the code that you ever wrote from the desktop, A, it probably wouldn't compile anymore. and if it did, there'd be bits missing. So it is pivotal. You might, you know, it's not like landing on the moon significance, but I think all of this stuff builds on the work of others, and we're all pushing in the same direction. And
no, I agree.
And I feel like you shouldn't diminish the effort that each individual person puts in, both as an individual and as part of the collective.
And the other thing as well is, as we talk about all the time in open source, you get projects like NTP, which are a tiny fucking detail that most people in the world wouldn't even know about. But when that breaks, bad things happen, right? I agree with you, Popey, that I think what makes open source so great is it's hundreds of thousands of pivotal moments. It's not just the single one. Like, we need to kind of get away from, you know, the big personalities of open source and the fact that they do what some people think of as most of the work, right? Whereas in reality, that's not the case. So, and what's interesting to me as well is when you talked earlier on about, like, the images that go into the model with the benches thing, or just in the disco biscuits thing. That's kind of how music, that's how art gets produced, isn't it? Like, when I write a song, that song is the output of thousands and thousands and thousands of other songs that I've listened to in my life that manifest in that. I think very few artists are genuinely groundbreaking. 98% of them aren't. They're creating derivative works from millions of inputs. And arguably that's what's happening with this AI thing, isn't it? Like, it's taken all these pictures, and then you're in the same way that I use a guitar to write a song, you're writing your source code to generate the output.
You're essentially automating the process of your art being the product of your own experience.
Right.
I like how you're comparing Jono using a Fender to Stuart using G-Edit. I like that.
Well, you know, seems fair. everyone has their own instrument to play.
And what is interesting, this is kind of getting a little bit metaphysical at this point, but
there's a lot in this of what is art?
You know? Yeah, I know. It's so interesting. Like when I write music, I am fundamentally limited to what I have learned, right? So my music can only be as good as the music that I've been exposed to.
No, I disagree.
There's a certain amount of like...
There's a lot of experimental and, you know, pushing the boundaries of what people consider to be music. Like you look at jazz, for example, that can go a bit out there.
Also, to a much more prosaic note, you can do things like download drum loops and stuff, right? You didn't have to think of them or write them or whatever.
Yeah.
You can paste. There are whole genres of music which are piecing together samples to make stuff, right? It's not someone sitting there with their warm guitar tone.
No. But what I'm saying is, I think the decisions you make in how you stitch things together or how you write songs or how you write lyrics or whatever, a lot of your creative experimentation will, in many cases, be from when you've heard other artists do it and you know, oh, it's okay to break down those boundaries. Because I think kids grow up in a world where everything is defined by rules, right? I was watching this amazing documentary series on Netflix called Abstract. And I was watching this one about this woman who makes kids toys. And she was saying the problem with a lot of toys is there's a right and a wrong way of playing with it, right? And
really?
kids love toys the most where there isn't a wrong. Like it's one of the reasons why Lego has been so successful is that there's the right way to build the car that you get in the kit. But then you can build anything you want outside of that. And so kids get out of that rigidity. And I think in many cases where you get really experimental music, it's where you get people who listen to all kinds of random shit and they're like, I don't feel limited by anything in particular. And the reason why I'm saying this is what's interesting to me about the AI thing is that other people can feed input into the model. So you can play the metaphorical equivalent to the guitar, which is writing the script. But then the model, which is the combination of artistic experience, can be fed from multiple different people. Like, whereas when you make art as a human being, you're limited to your own, what you know and what you've been exposed to.
Yes.
I wasn't lying when I said it was metaphysical.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, what I think is interesting about that, about what you're saying is, yes, this does essentially distill a whole bunch of experience, more than any one individual person could get into a thing. What I think will be most fascinating is a year from now or 2 years from now when we have this conversation again, but it's about music. And there are AIs out there where you'll tell it. Some AI people would say you can already do this, but you basically can't. But they would all say soon you'll be able to, where you could describe a song and it'll write a song and it'll be good.
Yeah. There's actually there's an AI, there's some guy on YouTube who generates AI death metal, and it sounds identical to other death metal bands.
I mean, obviously this is easier with death metal than, you know, good music, but the principle is
I feel like I'm coming round to this idea that we're in the embryonic stage of this. Like, there's a few of these models that you can use to generate the images and videos. It feels like we're in, like, I don't know, the 11th century when it comes to music making, and there's just so much more ahead of us. And like you say, if you came back to this in a year or 5 years or 50 years, there'd be more of these models that are trained on all manner of different things. And you could, maybe literally just think of something and press a button and it comes out. You get a hard copy of whatever it was, maybe even 3D printed model of the thing you were thinking of. It's certainly possible. And I do feel we're in very early stages of it.
And it can apply to anything, right? Because I forget who it is. There's some guy has written an ungodly amount of pop music that everybody knows, like Britney Spears, Katy Perry, all that kind of stuff. And he's got basically a formula that he uses. Like, he knows the songs need to be 3.5 minutes long. He knows there needs to be like an upbeat intro, whatever. Even like the BPM of these songs. So it wouldn't surprise me if AI will get to a point where you could replicate that formula. But then for the rest of it, like all the crazy jazz shit, like 12-minute songs with the, you know, 8-minute flute solo in the middle of it, that's just randomness. You know, like, you can create whatever you want with AI, right?
That you're describing, the idea of formulaic pop songs coming from like a playbook which generates the same thing. This is how people would tell you Simon Cowell made his money, and Stock right. Aitken and Waterman before him back in the 80s. Like, this is not a new complaint. Hey, look at identikit 50s crooners or identikit 50s girl groups, right? And you go, who's this song by? Is it the Marvelettes or is it the Cordettes or is it the Chilites? They're all the same.
As long as there's
been popular music, there have been cookie cutter band concepts.
ACDC is the exception here.
I feel like Airborne would disagree with you, but yeah. Okay.
One long song broken into 60 pieces.
Is that going to be the downfall of this? Like, the 37 different types of stories just get fed into the AI and Disney just punch out 1,000 films a year and you're done. That's it. There's no room for creativity then once the AI gets that good.
I think there's an uncanny valley here. I think there's an uncanny, and I think we'll always have an uncanny valley of, oh God, I'm going to sound like such a hippie, but like, I think it'll be very difficult for computers to really replicate feel.
Oh,
like, there is something
man.
About feel, you know, but Eric Clapton said it, right? He said, you know, it's not the notes that you play, it's the notes that you don't play. And it's so true. Like, I could play a passage on a guitar, but a really good guitarist, the way that person would play exactly the same notes would sound like a totally different piece of music. I don't know how computers will ever be able to.
You see, we've now stepped from what is art to what is art criticism, which is even harder. But the seminal work on this is I, Robot, starring Will Smith, where, have you seen it?
Yes.
Where Will Smith is talking to the robot, Sonny. And they're arguing about this precise point, whether a computer can create art. And Will Smith says to the robot, could you write a symphony? And the robot goes, could you? And you go, ooh. And it's quite an important, I mean, you know how you read sort of Zen koans and you're like, and then I was enlightened kind of vibe at the end of it where.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had this kind of, oh, blimey. Yeah, because you talk a big game about, yeah, computers will never be able to do that. But most people can't either. And it's very hard to get any 6 critics to agree on which piece of art actually does that, transcending the formula. Thing.
Well, I think part of it is that what makes a lot of things interesting is its mistakes. Like, a lot of the greatest music in the world is actually imperfect. You listen to Jimi Hendrix, and he makes all kinds of, like, the way he plays actually isn't technically perfect at all. And how do you teach a computer to be imperfect, right? I mean, outside of Kubuntu, obviously. Sorry, that was an unnecessary dig up.
For a bloke complaining about his sound not working before, yeah.
Hey, my sound works all the time, apart from when it doesn't work.
Defense rests, Your Honor. But but yeah, I mean, to me, I think the thing Poppy says there is the most important thing, that we feel like we're really near the beginning of this. It's so exploratory, and the field is changing really fast. And I've changed my tune on this quite a bit, because 10 years ago, I'll say, I always found it annoying in sci-fi stories where people didn't understand how the computer worked. Because, like, that's not how computers are, right? There's going to be someone who wrote all the scripts and everything. And now, increasingly, people are prodding at these AI models, trying to work out how to get it to generate the imagery you want, in the same way that you would experiment on a biological organism where you fundamentally don't understand it. And all you can do is experiment on it and see what you get back and learn from it. And it seems disappointing and annoying that things have to be like that, because we're crap at understanding things by examining them and by experiment. It would be much handier if we could understand how this works, but if that's the way it's got to work, yeah, maybe we end up in a future where we don't understand how a whole bunch of our technology actually works. All you do is learn what it's best at.
Well, we already don't know how the YouTube algorithm works, and you get recommended stuff. There's just a black box that just recommends stuff to you. And
sure,
if that gets scaled up to, you know, our operating systems, you come in the morning and it starts up random applications thinking you might need them because that's what you used a year ago today, or because other people who have your hair color start these applications in this order, or whatever, whatever it might be. And you just won't understand why. And I wonder if we're so early, embryonic, are we going to get to that point where we just don't know how computers work? And there isn't someone there who wrote the scripts, because one AI begats another AI, which begats another AI, and eventually it's turtles all the way down, and the script was originally written right down the bottom, and you've got no idea.
Yay, even unto the 50th generation. I mean, I think already the YouTube algorithm, I think in the early days of YouTube, someone sat down and worked out a bunch of rules. When someone watches a video like this, they watch a video like this. And then eventually all that went away, which is why tags aren't important anymore. And they realized that the recommendations you got were for other things like the thing you watched, but it wasn't actually increasing the amount of time you spent looking at YouTube. And now I don't think there's anyone out there who could explain the YouTube algorithm. There are people who know a lot more about it and what they use to train it and the kinds of parameters they're expecting into it and out of it and so on. But there's not anyone who can go, this is why you recommended that video because you'd watched those. I don't even think you could call it an algorithm. That's not the whole point of an algorithm is you have a bunch of defined inputs, a bunch of defined steps, and a bunch of outputs. It's an And fine, AI is like that because it's all executed on a computer, but it's like the weather is. If you could predict literally everything, you could do perfect weather prediction. But no one can because of chaos theory. You get sensitively dependent on initial conditions. And AI is the same.
It reminds me of a conversation. There's this woman at XPRIZE who, would just say just things like, you can't post to Facebook more than X number of times a day because it will impact the algorithm. And it's like, how could you possibly know that? You have no idea. Like, it's all guessing. Like, people, like you say, no one knows. No one knows how the people at Facebook do, but like...
Well, you see, that to me is the thing. I feel like in my head 10 years ago, I would have assumed that there was a line of source code somewhere which says, if post is greater than 4, importance equals importance minus 5 or something, right?
But there isn't.
Not anymore. I think maybe there used to be 15, 20 years ago, but now there just isn't. There's no actual line of code anywhere that says that. It's for the same reason that why is this butterfly the color it is? I don't know. Is this good? I feel
lots
like
lots to think about in this show, isn't there?
I know. Crikey.
We started out with Unsnap and we ended up with what is the definition of the universe? Like, I mean, well, we should probably wrap it up. We've been going for a while.
Yes. Although I feel we should take some time to thank the least automaton person on the earth, someone who does add a genuine personal touch to this show, which is Marius Quarbeck, who does the editing because he's brilliant.
Yes, he is. He puts a lot of work into it as well. Anyone who saw his live Twitch stream, thank you, Marius, for all the great work.
Yeah, I didn't even realize how much work he has to put into it. So cheers, Marius. That's really useful.
Puts a lot more in than what I used to do.
I can tell you, because you basically did it with an algorithm, which was just save them all in one Cubase thing and then press export as MP3.
The algorithm, there was an algorithm. It was get this done as quickly as possible.
Marius goes through and he cuts out all the silence. It's really, and so I don't know if his YouTube. I don't know if his Twitch stream is still available, but if it is, you should go and watch it. But if you need someone to do audio editing for you or media editing in general, have a look at nerdzoom.media and talk to Marius Quarbeck.
Yeah, he does video, does audio. Fantastic. Lovely guy. And thank you, Popey, for coming on the show. It's always a lot of fun.
No worries. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Is there anywhere people should go to find out more about what you're doing?
Yes, go to github.com/popey/unsnap.
Or the canonical glass door. find out what's happening.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much, people, and we'll see you next time.
Peace out.
Bye.